Hello one and all, and welcome back to Castle of Easter. As I'm sure you're all aware, Chris has moved house in the last couple of weeks and is sans internet right now, but we've been trying to keep you up to date with some content, at least. What we have here is a very special and momentous thing for Castle of Easter. It's our first ever real actual interview with a real actual film person. Chris was fortunate enough through his ties to Quad in Derby to sit down with Nick Whitfield, the director of the fantastic 2010 British movie Skeletons, which I saw and reviewed earlier this year at the Edinburgh International Film Festival. It does go straight into it. Bear in mind that in Chris's words, he was a bit of an idiot and forgot to press record. So have a listen and I'll see you guys on the other side. Oh, just one more thing before I go. Try and listen out for when dinner arrives. There might be a prize for the person who spots the right time correctly. See you then.
I was just interested about the budget of the film, really, because if anything, it doesn't show on screen how small the budget and the production was. That's a testament to yourself and the other people involved in the making of the film. Could you talk a little bit about the limitations and freedoms, perhaps, that you found in making it?
I think that we had enough money to shoot for 5 weeks, and that was the a big thing, so that we weren't trying to make a film in 12 days like people do, you know. That was massive. We had enough time to shoot the film, really. We didn't have time to mess about, which was a good thing. Other certain things that you find in the writing, you know, for example, there was a bit that happened out on the coast, and we didn't really have the resources and the time to get out to the coast and back. It would have cost us too much time, so we had to find other solutions to what those locations were that I'd imagined in the script. And there was a bit of that. There was a bit of kind of, we're in this town on this day, and you want, you know, say, a city cafe, you know, what can we do that's a compromise, that we're not going to drive to Nottingham or Sheffield or something to find a city cafe. So there's a lot of sort of thinking creatively about solving little problems like that, but I have to say, in the main, I was delighted with the amount of time and resources that we had, yeah.
At what point do you start in the process, especially as a writer-director, at what point do you start thinking, OK, how am I going to recreate what I've written in a visual way?
I guess you're doing both of those things, I would say, most of the time. You're just writing to try and make the story live, but at the same time, there's going to be certain limitations, but it's definitely the best thing at first to be as free as you can with your writing, with that in mind, and then solve any of those problems as they come up later on, because they're very much production problems rather than writing problems.
In that sense as well, is there a kind of a Nick with the director hat on and a Nick with the writer hat, or was it all seamless for yourself, or did you feel like you had to have different conversations at different times?
Well, definitely in the writing, you're a writer, you know, and you're just trying to make the script work, but before pre-production, really, you have to start thinking like a director. I don't really see a massive difference between those things. It's just, you know, I remember saying to the line producer 6 months before we shot, tell me your five biggest nightmares in this script, you know, tell me what they are, so that I'm forewarned about any potential problems. And that kind of thing helps, you know. Nick the writer and Nick the director, no, I think that you have to be a writer on set, because things come up, things change, and you have to be a director when you're writing, because it's not, you're not writing a hypothesis, you're writing something that you've got to bloody go and make work, you know. So I guess those things are always merging into each other.
I thought on a visual level, the film kind of had a very unique but at the same time very British landscape that it wanted to show, and that also audiences might have been particularly unfamiliar with. How important was it for you in making the film to represent the British countryside, and perhaps the East Midlands in particular, really, when you made it? Was it always a big agenda for you?
It was important for me for the characters to be in landscape. The landscapes used are the ones that I see every day, because that's where I live. And so it made very much sense for those to be the locations in the film. I guess I'm kind of inspired by American films, which often feature people in landscape. It's kind of, they're about that on some level. We wanted to create this timeless world where you weren't sure where you were in time and space. We didn't have great resources. We couldn't build sets of a parallel universe. But if you take people out into the landscape, then you could be at any time in the last however many years, you know, depending on what you've got in your frame.
Was it important for you then to kind of show off the place that you call home, or, you know, did you want to make it a showcase piece for that sort of landscape?
I wouldn't say that. No, I would say that it was more about putting characters in a landscape, and something about those two guys who are in the centre of the film in their suits with their briefcases, when they're walking across a moor, they become slightly more than two blokes who are at work. They become something other. I don't know what it is they become.
No, I agree. It's a kind of, there's an almost instant iconicism to it. You know, it repeats itself over the film, and then there's obviously a neat twist on it at the end of the film as well. But that, yeah, it's a starting image that it wouldn't be if they were just walking down a faceless road in a town centre or something like that. I think it certainly works. I thought if we could talk about a little bit about the casting of the film. Obviously, it takes full advantage of various different exciting cast members from different areas. We've got there's a Hollywood cameo in there, European favourites who have won like many awards in Denmark, even a British up-and-comer. But particularly for me, the interest is about the relationship between the lead characters played by Andrew Buckley and Ed Gowan. I mean, in terms of their on-screen presence, the chemistry is instantaneous. And obviously, I'm kind of aware that they do have a background relationship, a previous relationship themselves. Was that a kind of happy coincidence through the casting, or was it intentional? Like, if I'm going to get these two people, I want them to know each other straight away.
Oh, it was written for them to play. So the first thing I did was make a short film, and they were in the short film. That was the first time I really worked with them properly. I'd worked with them a bit in the theatre, but not in a major way. It was completely written for them. They're a brilliant double act. They've been working together for a long time, and that chemistry that they have, that you rightly identify, is brilliant and a total gift for someone like me. And so those characters were written for them, and indeed, you know, by them a bit, because that's the way that we work, because we work in quite an organic way. I workshop with them, and so they formed their characters as much as I did, I would say, yeah.
Couldn't help but draw slight comparisons between Skeletons and Deception this year, which kind of, in my opinion, they left a lot of the science and also the moral issues of their worlds for the audience to ponder over afterwards. How aware were you of these sorts of issues when you were making the film, and how prevalent did you want them to be? And how important is it to have faith in that same way for an audience to accept the film's world and figure things out for themselves as they watch it?
I think the trick when you're creating a world like that is to tell the audience just enough, and it's not too much. It's very important, because it's kind of fun to use this jargon, like this one's a glow chaser and we find out what that is, or this guy goes Bulgarian, or this guy, Faulkner and Gabriel, have split up because, you know, there's been problems and they're going to find him through isosceles tracking, they're going to have to go through the polygons. All of this stuff is kind of good fun, and I guess it's a film that sort of plays a bit of a game with telling you not quite enough. That's a sort of a fine line to draw, because if I tell you too much, then it's a bit dull, and if I tell you not enough, then you're going to get a bit angry with the film, because you're going to be confused in not a useful way. So I just try to keep you usefully confused, I guess.
I certainly think it succeeds in that way as well. I mean, perhaps maybe a cheeky kind of question, but like, having now had Inception be released as well, do you see comparisons between the two films in a kind of after the fact sort of like, oh my god, these, they do raise very similar issues?
Well, I have to admit that I've not seen it yet. And please don't tell me anything about it, because I'm really looking forward to seeing it.
I'll keep my mouth shut.
Yeah, but I've been trying to get to see it, and I just haven't managed it yet. I'm writing and busy and
touring as well, of course.
People have said it to me, but I always say, shut up, don't want to know anything about it, because I really want to go into that film, and I've done pretty well so far. I don't know anything, you know.
Talk about the touring. You've been touring it throughout the summer, throughout the UK, and I just wondered how you've been finding that experience in itself anyway, and how do you feel that the film is being received from screening to screening as it goes around?
It's been very interesting to go around. I mean, I've been lucky enough to see the film in foreign climes, you know, in a few festivals around the world in the last few months. It's really nice to bring it here, and I'm not a huge fan of Q&As as an audience member myself. You know, I kind of like to make my own mind up, although maybe I might have changed my mind a bit about that with this, because you can have some interesting interaction with the audience. I think it's been going well, you know. It's nice to see the warmth towards the film. You never know how it's going to be received. It went very well in America, and I still had some doubts about how it would go here because a different kind of audience to the audience here. But it seems to have gone well, and I've enjoyed it, yeah.
So in that sense, did you intentionally like try to create a film that you thought would work for an American audience as well, like, in a universal way perhaps, not even just American, but you know, maybe take a step away from a British identity sort of film?
I don't know whether I did that. I think that a lot of the films that I like are American films. I like the way that they work, the way they use story very well. The good ones, clearly they make a lot of not very good ones as well. I certainly didn't make a film trying to appeal to America. So when we sent a screener to South by Southwest, South by Southwest by return post said, "We want this film," I was quite surprised and pleased about that. And I was very, very happy. Thank you very much. I was very happy with the reception there. It was great, you know. So I think it's a mistake that British films make often, is that they try and ingratiate themselves to an American audience. And having been there with a film that people say is very British, you don't really have to do that because they go, it's so British, you know, and they like that. And then if your story delivers emotionally, which is what they're used to, a story kind of making an emotional deal with you and then delivering on it, if it does that, then they're going to, you know, it works for them. You don't have to make a lot of decisions that are compromises or trying to ingratiate yourself. I don't think that works very well. And it's definitely a mistake we make here.
Like, it's just a lot more natural. It's just if it's going to work, it's going to work. And it's, you know, it's up for them as audience members to decide wherever they're from, really.
Definitely, and it's not like a breakout success in America, like The Full Monty or anything. You know, it's doing well at festivals and it's got US distribution, but it's not going to be troubling the...
Time will tell. Well, my favourite touch of the film was the meal, the scene around the table, mostly because it was the fact that the table was made up of bread, rice, pasta, potatoes, and whatever it was inside that pan, well, I couldn't see. We guessed cauliflower.
Never got a shot of the mash.
Is it? It's mash. Okay. I thought it was cauliflower. But never mind. As far as that sort of thing works as well, do you intend from the beginning to give those visual clues to themes of the movie, or is that something that's a lot more natural as the film, as it's being shot, that you think, oh, this might be an interesting touch?
No, that was in the script. I mean, the point of that is to, I guess, to show that the character of Jane isn't used to cooking meals for people. She's bad at it, you know. And that thing of it all being carbs was just a way of doing that, a kind of playful way of doing that. So there's no more to it than that. I mean, I kind of wrote that not really thinking that it was any great shakes. And, you know, it's one of the things that people always comment on about the film, that it's, they think that's a very funny and abroad. They go, this is a very British meal, you know. And perhaps it is.
I've never had it myself, but, you know, I think it works on that way of, as you're watching the film and you start paying attention, you suddenly think, what is she serving up? What's that second dish? Is that... And then the potatoes come out, it's like, I have no idea what's going on here. This is interesting. The tour is continuing on and stuff, but what are your next steps? What happens next for Nick Whitfield and the film as well, really? Where do you go from here?
Well, the film is continuing to go around, you know, and it's having this sort of gradual release, which is quite good in a way, because it's a film like this has to have good word of mouth, otherwise we can't have things on the sides of buses, you know. And the film's got US distribution, which is nice, and I'm writing the next one and doing my best to support this film and without getting too distracted by it. So for me, it's writing and trying to tame a script again, which is a tough job. And for the film, what's happened so far with it has given it a good chance, you know, to get out to more people than maybe would have been the case. And I just hope that is as big as possible, just because, you know, there's a lot of love in the film and a lot of people worked really hard on it, and it's really nice for it to get out to audiences.
Any chance of a Skeletons 2, the Skeletons step out of the closet, do you think?
I think that's... We often joke that will be a few years down the line when we're all washed up and we'll have the... Like, Are You Being Served did one where they all went to Mallorca. We'll do Skeletons in Mallorca.
My final question, to finish up, is to say that, obviously, like you said before, the film is definitely timeless in its imagery, the mise-en-scene and the locations as well. But do you know the year that the film was set in, or did you purposely avoid setting it in one?
definitely purposely avoided it, yeah.
I mean, I can't press you on. What year is it then?
Well, no, I mean, it's just one of those things where it's... If you could pin it down, I'd be a bit disappointed, you know. Like with a lot of the things, people, you know, people always say, how did the Colonel get his scar, you know? What Harold Pinter always used to say when people asked him to decode his plays was, I told you everything that I knew, you know. I didn't leave anything out. That would be mean. So I didn't leave anything out.
It's up to you, Chris.
So there you have it, guys. One interview tied up in a neat little package. Kind of feels like we're growing up. Now we're doing stuff with, you know, real people. Anyway, for my part, I reviewed the film at the Edinburgh International Film Festival early in the year, and I had a ball with it. I think it's a great movie, and I really do urge and encourage you to all check out the film's website, which is skeletonsthemovie.co.uk, and find out when it's playing in your local area, because it's on a very limited release, and they're actually touring the release, so there's a Q&A in a lot of places where it's on at. So anyway, keep an eye out for it, have a look, and yeah, well, we'll be back next week, hopefully, if Chris's internet gets sorted in time with an actual episode. And until then, keep your eye on castlevista.com for more written content, and get in touch, mail at castlevista.com for email. I need help out still for Chris's Batman Castermind in the next episode. You can get us on Facebook on Castle of Easter, or follow us on Twitter. Until then, see you then. Which is then. Next time, then. Goodbye.